The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Brian, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Gene M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is April 20th, 2022. Before we get started, I don't see the counsel for the first case on. Can the other judges see other attorneys? Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay. Now I see you. Did you have your video off?
Yes,
I did.
Okay, yeah. Great. I just wanted to make sure you were there. I normally can see all the participants, but I guess I didn't have my grid view set up properly. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have five cases on our calendar today, three oral cases and two non-oral cases. We are hearing the oral arguments by Zoom today. The first case on our calendar today is A21-0916, State of Minnesota versus Nancy Jean Feltus. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. An appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer in the grid view on your Zoom screen that will show you how much time you have remaining in your argument. If there's any technology problem along the way, we'll stop the timer. The marshal will stop the timer. So we'll make sure you get your full 15 minutes for your argument. And just a quick reminder to those of you who are watching that we are recording this oral argument and no other recordings of our Zoom oral arguments are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So with that, we can get started with the oral arguments in our first case. I'll ask that counsel each identify yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Catherine LaPlante, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Nancy Feltus. The job for this court today is to critically analyze the trial court's order. Specifically, with respect to the findings of fact, these need to be evaluated for clear error, which means manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole, pursuant to State v. McCormick. The conclusions of law need to be looked at on a de novo basis, which means without deference to the trial court. I'm sure that you have read the briefing, but just by way of simple reminder, the evidence in this case includes eight things. It's five exhibits and it's three witnesses. The exhibits include the dash cam video, a copy of the state's policy regarding inventory of vehicles, the CV of expert Andrea Hilton, Andrea Hilton's written opinions, and medical records of Ms. Feltus. And then the three witnesses we have are Trooper Bosser, Ms. Nancy Feltus, and expert Andrea Hilton. And you will see, based on a thorough review of the evidence, that the weight is in Ms. Feltus's favor. And it's really important to note that the trial court didn't make any findings or determinations regarding credibility, yet it treats Trooper Bosser's testimony as though it's more credible than anyone or anything else in the record. Bosser's testimony is largely taken as fact, and the rest of the record is largely ignored by the trial court. There's numerous clear errors with respect to the findings of fact here. I'm just going to highlight a few for you. And I think that once you review the findings of fact and we can actually get the weight of the evidence taken as fact, that your conclusions of law will come out differently than the trial court's. So with respect to the first erroneous finding of fact, I'll refer you to what's called the walk and turn test. And that was one of the field sobriety tests that was performed in this case. The trial court found that Ms. Feltus failed this test. And that's found at the addendum page 4, paragraph 14D. What the trial court did is it looked at Trooper Bosser's testimony, and Trooper Bosser testified that on the way out on the walk and turn test, Ms. Feltus did not use the correct number of steps, but that she did on the way back. And that's found at the transcript of the omnibus hearings at page 24, lines 21 to 22. However, the dash cam video, which is evidence in the record, shows that Ms. Feltus actually did walk 9 steps out, turn around, and walk 9 steps back. And that's exactly what she was supposed to do. So the clear error here is the trial court taking as fact Trooper Bosser's testimony, which was obtained approximately 9 months after the traffic stop happened, instead of looking at what actually happened and the better source of evidence, and that is the dash cam video. So Ms. clearly,
LaPlante, if I can jump in and ask a couple more questions about what you observed from the dash cam video, was there any swaying or loss of balance during that walk and turn test?
Very little. And she did tell the officer that she was nervous and that she has bilateral knee pain and problems. And there is further evidence of that in the medical records. So there is a very reasonable explanation.
I do recall that argument about what impact or what the effect is of the knee conditions. But putting that aside for a second, just on the walk and turn part of the field sobriety test, not the others, but just the walk and turn, did you observe the toe and the heel in the right places on each of these steps?
Yes, and that's an excellent question. So on the dash cam video, you can't always see her feet just by the way that the video is positioned. So on the first few steps out, I don't know exactly how many, you really can't see her feet. And then she turns around and comes back. And I don't recall whether or not I could see exactly the heel toe, but you can very clearly see the number of steps that were taken both out and back on the dash cam video. And that starts at minute 15 and 25 seconds or so.
If I could take a step back and have you for a minute discuss on our standard of review for clear error, appellate courts don't typically reweigh evidence. If there's conflicting evidence, one testimony versus someone else's testimony, or if there's something that has to be that's irreconcilable, it has to be sort of picked by the trier of fact or the fact finder. That's not our job, right? That's something we would defer to the district courts to do.
Yes, you can certainly do that, but I think it behooves you all as the Court of Appeals to look at the best source of evidence here. And when we have video evidence of exactly what happened and it doesn't square with the subsequent testimony of a witness, I think it behooves the court to pick the evidence that clearly shows what actually happened. You know, it would be a different scenario if we had two competing witness testimonies that both were looking back in time and said, I think I remember it this way or this way. But that's not what we have here. We have witness testimony that's based on recollection, and then we have video evidence of the very stop. So does that answer your question, Judge?
Well, I agree that to the extent there's a conflict between the dash camera and the testimony, that the dash camera shows, right, what actually happened. My question was a little bit more general regarding what our standard of review, clear error, requires us to do and prohibits us from doing when it comes to weighing evidence. There's evidence regarding, let's get to the knee conditions, for example. And as the district court is weighing evidence, that's something we don't second guess, right?
Yeah, so actually the standard of review for clear error is what does the manifest weight of the evidence say? And so it's our position that, frankly, Trooper Bosser's testimony is just one of 8 sources of evidence. And frankly, the other 7 really weigh in Ms. Feltus's favor in a lot of respects.
Counsel, how does this error that you're alleging affect the district court's legal analysis and conclusions of law?
Yep, that's a really good question. So you'll see as you read through this order, there actually is very little analysis performed. And that's something that I would really like you all to take a look at. When you look at the conclusions of law, and it's like this in, with pretty much all of the issues, but there will be a few paragraphs that set out statements of the law. And then the final paragraph is a conclusion with maybe a sentence or two of analysis. And I think if we really look at all of the evidence as a whole, there could be a much more robust analysis of what's going on here. And so my overall point is that reliance so heavily on this one source of evidence, that is the trooper's testimony, is clearly erroneous.
Well, counsel, but you're challenging one specific finding of fact. So are you arguing that as a result of, if we were to agree with you that there was clear error on that one specific finding of fact, there was not probable cause to charge her with DWI?
Right. So if
you... Given all the other facts in the record.
Yep. So first of all, the one specific finding of fact that I'm challenging right now is not the only one. And that's going to be part of my overall argument and point here is that if you watch the dash cam video, it tells a much more thorough story about what happened that day. And it tells us, you know, things that didn't come out in Trooper Bosser's testimony, which is heavily what's relied upon. So it's not my position that just simply this one finding of fact, if you find it incorrect, is going to lead to there not have been, you know, probable cause to arrest. But if you look at all of the factual errors here, those in sum will lead you to come to different legal conclusions. And, you know, along a similar vein, another a factual error here is the court's finding at addendum page 5, paragraph 15. The court said Trooper Bosser, quote, inquired, close quote, as to the defendant's use of chemical substances. This is error. If you watch the dash cam video and you look at the totality of the circumstances, Trooper Bosser didn't simply make an inquiry as to Ms. Feltus's historical use of chemical substances. She said, quote, so let's talk, period. And then she started interrogating Ms. Feltus about her prior use of chemical substances. This is not an inquiry. When you look at the dash cam video, again, not just looking at Trooper Bosser's testimony, but you look at the dash cam video, you'll see that this was not a voluntary interaction. And the custodial standard is whether a reasonable person under the circumstances would believe that they're in custody to a degree associated with formal arrest or deprived of their freedom in any significant way. That's the State versus Mentor case. And here, it's our position that Trooper Bosser didn't make an inquiry. She made a command. And so Ms. Feltus at that point in time was deprived of her freedom to such an extent that she should have been considered in custody for Miranda purposes. And there's no, in the Berkemer case, it also lays out this reasonable person test. And that's no objectively reasonable person would feel free to leave in this situation. And what tells us what's objective, right? How do we decide what an objectively reasonable person is going to feel free to do? Well, how about we look at the law that governs them, right? In Minnesota, it's a felony to flee or attempt to flee a police officer, and it's a misdemeanor to willfully fail or refuse to comply with the orders and direction of a peace officer. That right there tells us that objectively a reasonable person is not going to say, oh, you know what, officer, I'm actually going to walk away from this interaction right now. This very court actually said in the In Re Welfare of KLC case, that's 2012 Westlaw 118414, open quote, interrogation under Miranda refers to express questioning or words or actions on the part of the police, other than those normally attendant to arrest and custody that police should know are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response from the defendant. And that is exactly what we have here. Trooper Bosser asked Ms. Feltes, so what have you used in the past for controlled substance-wise? Ms. Feltes' statements here are clearly a result of custodial interrogation, should have been suppressed.
We see many cases, DWI cases, where the encounter between the officer and the driver includes a question such as, have you been drinking? That would be a question designed to elicit an incriminating response. But we don't conclude that that transforms the encounter into an in-custody situation requiring Miranda. So I guess my question is, do you agree that there's one test to decide if a seizure has occurred, such as a Terry stop, or even the types of seizures that require probable cause? There's one test to determine if a Fourth Amendment seizure has occurred, and a separate test to determine whether or not the Fifth Amendment is implicated requiring Miranda. Do you agree that there are two different tests that courts apply for those two different circumstances?
Yes, it does appear that that's the case. And I would also say that with respect to a simple question like, have you been drinking? I think that sort of assumes that you're at the beginning of a traffic stop and the criminal suspect is still sitting behind the wheel of their car and they're having a conversation with the officer. And that's not what we had here, right? Ms. Feltes was stopped. She was pulled out of her car. Her pulse was taken. She had to go through four field sobriety tests. Her pulse was taken again. Then she gave a PBT test. This traffic stop lasted 52 minutes. This was not a brief interaction. And Harum acknowledges that, you know, the brevity or lack thereof of the stop is a relevant factor. And just with my brief remaining time I have left, I wanted to note one other clear error for the court, and that is the notion that there was a safety concern posed by the location of this traffic stop. Trooper Bosser testified that this traffic stop occurred on a bridge on a hill. This is objectively verifiable. You can look at the altitude of the traffic stop on Google Earth, and you'll see there is very little altitude from where the traffic stop occurred and immediately prior to that. So with that, I will turn it over to respondent.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Justin Lee, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. I would note for the court that the original author of the respondent's brief, Ms. Destash, has since become Mrs. Klein endorsed, and she's no longer with her office. However, I'm happy to be before you today in order to request you to uphold the district court's denial of the appellant's motion to suppress. Excuse me, the state trooper's investigation of the appellant from the traffic stop through to the vehicle search was incrementally reasonable and supported by law. The district court correctly addressed the four issues raised by the appellant, finding that first, the expansion of the traffic stop was reasonable. Second, that the appellant was not in custody for purposes of Miranda prior to her arrest. Third, that sufficient probable cause existed to support the appellant's arrest. And finally, that the search of the appellant's vehicle was reasonable pursuant to the inventory search exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. And as we've discussed already today, this court reviews district court legal determinations de novo, factual findings for clear error. However, in reviewing those factual findings, this court also gives due weight to the inferences drawn from those facts by the district court. That's State v. Lee. And also, I think is relevant here, the Champion case, in which the court found that the trial court used the proper legal standard to make fact-specific determinations and did not clearly err in making a determination regarding Miranda issues. So really, they were looking at a legal determination regarding Miranda, but they still gave that deference to the inferences drawn from the district court's findings of fact.
Counsel, in terms of the Miranda issue, I think our case law suggests that a motorist subject to a traffic stop is not usually in custody for Miranda purposes. But was this traffic stop a typical traffic stop, you know, under the Miranda analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it was. It's a standard DWI stop in many aspects. The appellant points to the length of the stop, but if you look at things incrementally and step by step and the way things played out, the trooper was never elongating the stop inappropriately or doing anything like that. The appellant pointed to the Harem case, and that case analyzes some situations where a traffic stop may convert to a situation where Miranda would be appropriate. And it gave some examples specifically that ordering a person to lie on the ground does not necessarily necessitate a Miranda warning. It referred to an instance of pointing a gun at a suspect didn't necessarily require a Miranda warning. So I would look to those things as direction, and also the totality of the stop and what happened. Yes, it was 52 minutes, which may be longer than most traffic stops. But as far as a DWI stop that necessitates going through field sobriety tests and, you know, all of those step-by-step things, there's nothing really out of the ordinary that occurred here that would necessitate that Miranda warning.
Mr. Lee, if I could jump in here, because I think that there are cases that deal with post-arrest, pre-Miranda silence, or even statements that a defendant might make. There seems to me to be a pretty big distinction between what counts as an arrest or what counts as and what would be what would trigger Miranda or require Miranda. Maybe you could speak to that distinction a bit and help us understand kind of how we're in the middle of potentially those two different standards.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So the test for Miranda is if an objectively reasonable person would have felt themselves under formal arrest, restraint, or that their freedom of movement was inhibited to a similar degree. And tie in somewhat to the appellant's argument regarding traffic stops and it being a crime to flee from a traffic stop, as we've discussed in Harem, in most traffic stops do not necessitate that Miranda warning. So I just wanted to briefly address that as well. But to answer your question, Your Honor, in most situations prior to an arrest, the Miranda warnings is not required. And specifically in Champion, the court goes through a list of factors to consider. Whether the defendant or suspect is in custody at the time, factors such as, you know, did it happen at a police station? Were they in handcuffs? Was the door of the room locked at the time? How many officers were present? And looking at all those things in our current situation where we're on the side of a road, again, it's a fairly normal, straightforward traffic stop. There's nothing there that would require that Miranda warning. I would like to address the issue of the expansion of the stop, as the appellant has challenged whether that was reasonable. As I've already stated, Trooper Bozer went through incremental steps throughout the stop from the beginning of the stop all the way through the search. It was step by step. Everything was supported by reasonableness per Terry. And the State v. Askertooth case explains how expansion is okay in three circumstances. If it's related to the original legitimate purpose of the stop, if there's independent probable cause, or based upon reasonableness. And in appellant's brief, it focuses mainly on that independent probable cause portion, and it doesn't address the reasonableness portion, which I think is very important. Reasonableness was present throughout this stop. excuse me. And the appellant asserts in her brief that the purpose of the stop was to investigate whether Ms. Feltus was driving while impaired. Now, the respondent and the district court agree with that. And my question is, where is this expansion? So the appellant is arguing that the inventory search itself was an unreasonable expansion. Now, for one thing, I don't believe it's unreasonable based on those incremental steps that have been taken throughout and are explained in detail in the brief. But furthermore, I don't think it would be appropriate to even address this under an expansion of the stop issue, as the stop is concluded when the inventory search occurred. The stop happened, she was arrested, and then the inventory search occurs. So I don't believe it's appropriate to even go down that road regarding stop expansion. we've addressed Miranda. I'd like to address the sufficient probable cause supporting the appellant's arrest. Probable cause is an objective standard based on the totality of the circumstances. The district court correctly noted in their order that a single indication of intoxication may be sufficient to provide probable cause to believe a person's under the influence. And those indications may include sweating, dilated pupils, anxiousness, and fidgety behavior. Now, the appellant's claiming that the district court failed to consider the appellant's medical conditions. But the district court did state in their order that, quote, they are not convinced by the defendant's or the appellant's explanations for her driving conduct, her demeanor, and her performance through the field sobriety testing. Now, I'd put to this court that right there is the district court addressing those excuses, those explanations, that the medical conditions with her knee, her being tired and wanting to pull over, et cetera. The appellant also claims in her brief that the district court failed to consider Ms. Hilton's expert opinions regarding the pulse of the appellant. But the court did address that in a footnote. excuse me. And stated that, quote, eliminating the pulse rate in the assessment of determining probable cause to arrest, the court concludes that there remains sufficient indications of intoxication to support probable cause to arrest. And the district court goes through and lists all these different indications of impairment, such as failing the Romberg test, where she estimated the passage of 30 seconds and 24 seconds, in having that distinct eye twitch and seeming to fall asleep during the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, taking the incorrect number of steps during the walk and turn, having heat bumps on her tongue. Then the court also mentioned swaying during the Romberg test, using arms to balance for the one leg stand and the walk and turn test, failing to touch heel to toe in the walk and turn test, seeming to lose her balance on multiple occasions, and the two instances of elevated pulse, the 104 and the 112 beats per minute. So even if you find that the pulse shouldn't have been considered and that the knee conditions weren't properly considered, excise the illegality from that, and you're still left with the Romberg, the eye twitch, the falling asleep, the incorrect steps, the heat bumps on the tongue. Those are all unchallenged indications of impairment. When the district court has stated correctly that probable cause could be found with only one of those, potentially.
Also, with regard to the incorrect number of steps, Helen's counsel argues that the dash cam refutes the district court's finding. Can you address that argument?
Your Honor, truthfully, I cannot. This is the first I've heard that argument, and I could not tell you.
Yeah, I'm not sure that argument was made in the brief. I was just looking back at it, and I did, you know, review the dash cam video, and observed her walking and turning but I appreciate your forthrightness and your answer to that question. I have another question for you with regard to the impoundment in appellant's brief. They argue that the officer had a duty to explore with appellant whether she had someone who could come retrieve the car for her before the officer, that the officer should have done that before deciding to impound the car. Can you address that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. So generally, the police have the authority to seize and remove from the streets vehicles impeding traffic or threatening public safety. Supreme Court has said that is beyond challenge. Now, to address your question, whether that's through a tow or whether getting someone to come and pick up that vehicle, I don't agree that it is a statutory requirement, I believe is how the appellant put it, to have someone get that. Now, the appellant cites to this case State v. Reese, which is a non-presidential case, stating that the tow was unreasonable. And one of the reasons they argue there is that someone was there to drive the car away. In that State v. Reese case, that's one of the reasons that this court found that it was unreasonable to tow the vehicle because someone was there. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And just to continue on that State v. Reese case, I did want to address that the main reason that the court found that tow was unreasonable is because no documentation was provided that there was a tow policy, and that the court found that there was not a public safety hazard in that case because it was parked at a gas station and was not blocking any pumps, which is very different from here where it was on a bridge. There seems to be some confusion over whether or not it was a hill or not, but the district court did make a finding of fact that it was a public safety hazard. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Any rebuttal for appellant?
Yes, thank you, Judge. I'm just going to address a couple of things quickly. Counsel for respondent mentioned the inventory of impounded vehicles policy. That is an exhibit in this case. You'll see it's exhibit 2. That policy directly states that, open quote, it is the policy of the Minnesota State Patrol to conduct inventories of lawfully impounded vehicles, close quote. In order to be a lawfully impounded vehicle, we need to look at what is the law that governs these scenarios. And I think it's pretty clear, and I think respondent agrees that, you know, if there is a legitimate safety concern or traffic hazard, and the language traffic hazard comes out of Minnesota statute 168B.04, then there might be a legitimate reason to tow the vehicle and therefore perform an inventory search. In this case, when we look at the totality of the evidence, we see that this car was parked pretty much not on a hill. I think that the difference in elevation was a matter of 2-3 meters based on the location of the traffic stop, and then looking, you know, 100-300 meters before the traffic stop. The dash cam video will show you that it was light outside. The dash cam video will show you that numerous vehicles pass the traffic stop without any issue. There was no ice or debris on the road. The size of the shoulder is generous. It's larger than the size of Ms. Feltus's car, and it's the same size as the shoulder on the rest of the road, or very, very similar. And you can see that in the dash cam video as well. It's
Ms. LaPlante, sorry to interrupt. Like you're just asking us to reweigh the evidence, which is not what we do in our review of a district court's order.
Sure. Right? But you have to look for what's manifestly contrary to the evidence. Where are the facts that are manifestly contrary to the evidence? And when we look at the evidence as a whole, it looks like the trial court cherry-picked something out of the trooper's testimony and ignored or largely ignored everything else, right? And the dash cam video shows this.
Can I just
counsel?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Judge Gaitis. I'll follow up.
I just want to jump quickly to your expansion argument. Mr. Lee argued that this wasn't an expansion of, you know, that none of this was an unlawful expansion of the traffic stop because the investigation related to the purpose of the stop, which was to investigate a possible impaired driving offense. And I guess I'm a little confused about what the expansion is as well. Could you please address that for me?
Yes, absolutely. I think that it's pretty clear that there are a couple instances of expansion. I think the first instance of expansion that was brought up at the court below is ordering Ms. Feltus out of the vehicle to perform the field sobriety test. I will admit, I think that is the weaker of the two. The second instance of expansion is where the trooper begins interrogating Ms. Feltus about her prior drug use and asking her what's in the vehicle when she had no reasonable suspicion that there might be anything in that vehicle. So I think that there's a couple of instances of that. And I think that we need to really pay attention to what the case law says about impounding a vehicle. State v. Holmes says it's got to be necessary. And State v. Goodrich says necessary means essential. And you get the safety concern language from the Gouster case. So the state, their interest in impounding a vehicle has got to outweigh an individual's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The state has the burden to prove that the impoundment is lawful. And that's State v. Rohde. It's R-O-H-D-E. And based on the evidence in the record, the state has not been able to show that. And so what I really would love for you guys to do is perform a review of all of the evidence and look at the trial court's findings of fact. And I think that you will see that they are manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence that's provided. And then once you've got that squared away, when you make your legal conclusions, I think that you will find that they come out differently than the trial courts did. Thank you.
Thank you for the rebuttal. And thank you very much to both counsel for your